I'm going to talk today about a piece of music I wrote for choir. I'm going to give you some background about the subject. I'm going to play a little bit of video here and there, and then I'm going to play about a third of the piece for you at the end of the lecture. There should be time for questions and answers if you have them. So the name of the piece is Unbodyings, and I'll get into that in a bit, but it is all about primarily the area just east of here, Quabbin. How many of you have been to Quabbin? Okay, good. So I'm going to give you some background on a place that hopefully you know and love, and then connect it to some other places in the world. So if you don't know where it is, I'm going to orient you in space here. We are here, Amherst. This is Quabbin, this big blob here, and it's about 60 miles to Boston. And that's how far the water travels to serve Boston. Quabbin exists as a water source primarily for Boston and the surrounding communities. I first came to know about Quabbin taking ILS with Tom Looker. And yes, this is the actual website, which is still up, which I was floored to find when I did a search for it. You'll notice the, this is straight HTML, old school. Some sort of standard readings, McPhee, Thoreau, and also another one which I didn't remember reading, but Sand County Almanac, and I just discovered that, rediscovered. I probably should have read it 20 years ago. I didn't, and I read it about a year ago. It's a wonderful diary of life in the Midwest and this particular gentleman's experiences. This is me, circa 1995. Anybody recognize this guy? That's Jonathan Bell. Yep, he's not here, I don't believe, but he's. We were hiking. This is the summer after freshman year. We were hiking in the White Mountains. By the way, I really do strongly recommend you check this out. It's like going into a museum of how we used to do HTML, and it's just up there, and it's fantastic. So, this is a photo I took last year in the Prescott Peninsula, which is an area that's generally closed to the public. The Swift River Heritage Society runs trips about every 9 to 12 months, and I took my family out down there. This is not far from where Daniel Shays' house supposedly was. Daniel Shays, of course, of Shays' Rebellion, late 18th century, rabble-rouser, depending on who you ask. The Europeans that settled the valley in the late 18th century were mainly English. There were four towns incorporated: Greenwich, Dana, Enfield, and Prescott. The early residents include Daniel Shays, who I mentioned. The 19th century saw the valley really come into its own. Local industry included box making, straw hats and bonnets, soapstone fixtures, and, of all things, billiard legs, in addition to agriculture. The valley even got its own railroad in 1871 that ran between Athol to the north and Springfield to the south. The total population at its height was about 10,000 people. Changes in economy and agriculture in the beginning of the 20th century, as well as the Great Depression, saw that number sink down to about 2,500. I want to take a moment to introduce the person I collaborated with, Todd Herron, wonderful poet. He is not only a poet, but he plays mandolin and banjo and sings and is a songwriter. He's a very interesting, fascinating guy, a playwright, a director, has written a novel as well. And when I took him there, we went on a couple of long walks along the shoreline. You could just see the wheels turning when I started telling him the stories about this. And he came up with four brand new, beautiful poems taking on various aspects of what it means to be displaced, not just in Quabbin, but in various ways and in various places throughout history. I want to give you a sense of his voice. It's a wonderful voice, I mean, his speaking voice. So here's Todd reading the second part of the four new poems. With any luck. Come on, PowerPoints. Come on. Here we go.
The Valley of Lost Names. Think of a time our own names conjure nothing but a body of unbroken water. Moon over Quabbin, body of bottled light poured across the body of the water, something far at the surface, finned or feathered, rolling in distress. At dawn, the sudden trumpeting eagle strikes. The drowned towns, foursquare, hemmed in stave and stanza, swallowed walls on walls of song, each stone a tongue, where the salmon canter over the meadow baffled dam, and small-mouthed bass hosanna. Too deeply now for any to remember, so why does it seem important to remember, when we will ourselves, these fluent selves, like water, subsumed in greater water, be impossible to remember, to distinguish the veins in the hand that worked the lathe, wove the straw, rippled at morning into a gesture of love or praise, or clipped the dewy lilac from its stem, or turned the field stone into the sunken wall of a cellar hole, the jam jars lined within, the vagrant bittersweet unwinds among, when the shore recedes in the twinkling of an eye. The tombs stick out like knees. Deep in a time that is no longer time, but the greater dissolutions of the water, within whose workings ever unspool our names, as it were, as it will be, upon a ghostly bobbin.
A great reading voice. Wonderful singer as well. So as I said before, the Quabbin serves as a water supply for mainly for Boston. It's about 400 billion gallons of water, which sounds like a lot, but Lake Mead and Lake Powell really dwarf it. It's the largest in the area, certainly in the Northeast. Engineers had been considering this area, the Swift River Valley, for a reservoir since about 1895. The steep granite slopes and ample incoming water made an ideal location, requiring only a dam and a dike to hold back the three branches of the Swift River. Plans were drawn up, a funding bill was passed, and in 1927, the process of moving or destroying all structures, moving graves, clearing trees, bulldozing topsoil, and constructing the dam and the dike commenced. In 1938, the towns were legally disincorporated. The construction of Quabbin was contentious for obvious reasons, as it required the remaining residents to sell their homes and relocate. Thomas Kuhnwell summarizes some of the issues in his book, Quabbin, The Accidental Wilderness. Quote, "It is easy to see why the Swift River Valley was considered expendable by state water planners. No major businesses would be ruined, no major highways disrupted, no prominent landmarks buried by the waters of Quabbin. The Swift River Valley was a small, out-of-the-way place, totally lacking the political or financial power that could have saved it." Windsor Dam itself is an earthen dam, one of the largest such in the eastern United States. It measures about a half a mile across. It's about 170 feet high and over 1,000 feet wide at its base. At full capacity, the reservoir holds over 400 billion gallons of water. And at one point I did the math. I thought it would be interesting to say, and that's however many Olympic swimming pools. It's still a huge number. It's an unthinkable amount of water, serving up about 200 million gallons daily to about 2.5 million residents in the Boston area. The quality of the water is reputed to be quite high, in part owing to the fact that it takes water about 2 years to flow all the way through the reservoir. To give you a sense of what it looked like, this is a shot from near what is now called the Enfield Lookout. This is 1927, the town of Enfield here. You can see the downtown with the church. I think this is Town Hall. And there's a river. This is the Swift River running down this way, and there's the railroad. This is what it looked like in 1939. There's a cemetery that I'm going to show you later, and that cemetery is right there. You can see it right there on the earlier photo. And you can actually still see the terraces. They're most of the time they're above water, and they're fairly clear. Notice also that there was a massive hurricane in 1938, which knocked down many, many trees and was ironically actually kind of helpful in clearing this area. And this is a shot from the 80s. And you can see the cemetery is right in here. It's hard to see in this picture. But if you look, there is a mountain, now an island. The dam itself is down here. So we're looking northeast, just to orient you. And the dike is over here. So the dam is here, dike is here. Amherst College is that way. This is a shot I took about a year ago from more or less the same place. This is all lovely fog, but that's that same island right there. And the cemetery is right in there, give or take. The night before the official disincorporation, that was April 27, 1938, there was a gala ball at the Enfield Town Hall. People came from miles around, many locals, but there were a few interested folks, perhaps with a morbid curiosity, who wanted to take part. One of the things I love about this is the time, 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. At midnight, the town no longer existed, at least legally. So these people started their party in the town of Enfield and ended in an unincorporated area which would become Ware, maybe. I'll show you on the map where it is now, but it's either in Ware or maybe New Salem. And I love this as well. So, Grand March in Portland. No idea. Paul Jones two-step. No idea. But this is an old dance card. Somebody named Milton had claimed the 13th dance. Thought that was nice. And the second, well, somebody checked off the second one too. This person did not do much dancing, it would appear. And this is a wonderful photo taken the night of. I love the band packed up in there with the piano and the double bass and the bunting. And to give you a little bit of a sense of, so here's Enfield down here. That little star is more or less where Town Hall would have been. And this is going to morph into a modern map. So Enfield is now part of Ware down here. This is New Salem, actually, coming down here. Prescott Peninsula, this is the area that's closed to the public. There used to be a UMass radio telescope out there that has since been closed. When we were out there, I'm pretty sure it's even been torn down. But you can imagine, talk about quiet places. It's a wonderfully quiet place. There is nothing out there. It's delightful. And this area here, I believe, is Pelham, Shutesbury, and Belchertown. This is a corner of Belchertown. It took about 7 years to fill, just to give you an idea again of the size of this place. It took about 7 years to fill up. I'm going to talk for a minute about this term, disincorporation. The roots are pretty straightforward. Corpora, body. To incorporate something means to bring something together into a body. To disincorporate something then means to take it apart again. And so our title is very clearly taken right out of that, this idea of the body here. And Todd and I talked about this, and I want to play another short clip of Todd and I talking about this title, because I think he has some insights that he will give better than me trying to paraphrase.
So this word disincorporation, which is such legally, such sort of Latinate...
Oh, it's a horrible word.
...ridiculousness... And I want to ask you about the first time you heard that word. I mean, the bits and pieces are not hard to pull apart.
Yeah.
But what did you think when you heard disincorporation?
It's an assault on sensibility. You know, those words that are functionally correct, you know, bureaucratic. And so disincorporation, you know, well, the town had to be incorporated first, which, you know, and I love the presence of the body in there at the court, the bringing it into corporality.
Yeah, right. To bring it into, to create a body out of something.
Yeah, so it's been embodied. And I think that we wanted to inflict a similar sort of violence on language in our title, which takes the word unbodyings and, you know, chops it with slashes. And so in a way, our title, I think, is a talk back to disincorporation.
I mean, in some ways, it's a translation.
Yeah.
But by chopping it up, we allow the people to sort of looking at what we're embodying.
You're right.
Unbodying. Unbodyings? What bodies are we talking about?
Right. And we were able to bring in the sense of verb as well as noun. So it's not just the body, but it brings in to body something forth. Which is Shakespeare too, right? And as imagination bodies forth ... and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. And I thought that we were doing something similar there. We were giving this body of water and sort of the experience of the people who had, and things, creatures who've been there, we were giving it a local habitation and a name by bodying forth, you know, something of our reaction to or feelings about the place.
And there's also the quite literal reference to the fact that the bodies were taken.
Exactly.
There were more bodies exhumed and reinterred than there were people alive. It was something like 2,500 people who were displaced, but there were almost 7,500 graves that had to be accounted for, removed, and reinterred elsewhere.
And the violence implicit in that process of, you know, chopping up, not chopping up the body, but there were remains that you were, and not in many cases, you know, graves that were going back to the 17th century. What are you picking out and transporting, carting off, again, to a hill, to higher ground,
to the
new Quabbin Park Cemetery that you and I have spent time in.
And I've been able to track down.
So I'm going to take over again. So this is a photo by Bert V. Brooks, an early resident, this is probably around 1910, and this is that Enfield Cemetery I was pointing out earlier. This is a wonderful glass plate. He was an amateur photographer, but some of his images, I'll show you a bunch of his images. They are fantastic. And with digital manipulation, you can actually go in and read many of these names. And I've been able to find many of these in the new Quabbin Park Cemetery. They're very well. When anything was taken out of an old cemetery, it was a card was created for the family for that plot. And so, if you have the name, you can track down where they are now. And this is the Pope family. I was able to actually look into Freeman Pope. He was a captain in the Revolutionary War. This is his daughter Julia. She appears on the backside of this card. This is Quabbin Park Cemetery today. Every Memorial Day, I believe it's Memorial Day, they hold sort of a get-together. It's part memorial to veterans, and it's also part sort of a get-together for the families. There are very few folks who still are alive who lived there. I think it's a very small number at this point. But many second generation will get back together to celebrate their ancestors. It's a wonderful event. It's very there's a little parade and everything. But you see, one of the things that Todd talked about is the plots. Your neighbors, so to speak, in the cemetery would not necessarily be your neighbors in the new Quabbin Park Cemetery. These plots were rearranged. They were very respectful. Everybody who writes about it says that there was a lot of deep respect given to the remains. But still, there's a reorganization that goes on, which is in some way in our culture, we think of our final resting place really being our final resting place, and for these people, it was not. One of the other interesting things is that there were Civil and Revolutionary War monuments in each of the four towns. This one is a lovely Civil War monument, Gettysburg. I love this detail here, the cannon as the corner. These were all moved. This one here is, I believe, a Revolutionary War. These are cannons from, I believe, the Civil War. I'm not sure. But all four towns had monuments that were now gathered together in Quabbin Park, which is poignant. So a little bit more about the music. I was asked to write this piece by a choir in Philadelphia called The Crossing. Every June they do a concert series where they have all brand new music. And every year they have a theme. The theme last year was diaspora. They were looking at the ways in which people spread out into the world. And it was a pretty loose theme. And I knew about Quabbin, and I presented this idea of talking about Quabbin as a diaspora of sorts. And when I got thinking about it, diaspora began to mean a lot of different things to me. The Nipmuc people lived there first. There were, you know, several thousand native peoples who used this as a hunting ground. They were nomadic peoples. This was one of the places they would come and hunt and fish. The Europeans came in, spent 250 or so years, then they were moved. Ironically, as a result, the wildlife has come back. And it's written about, the Thomas Kuhnwell book talks about this very, very eloquently. He calls it the accidental wilderness. This was not really on anybody's radar. They wanted a clean water supply. And what they got was a clean water supply and a really amazing wildlife area. This is another photo by Bert V. Brooks. These glass plates are at the Swift River Museum, and the UMass Special Collections has scans online. If you're interested in finding out more, I recommend going to that site. They're all available, very high quality. This is a view of the eastern part of Quabbin. So in creating the music for this piece, I considered the Swift River Valley through a variety of lenses relating to ideas of diaspora, populations in motion. Homes, abandoned, claimed and reclaimed. Amherst College actually owns a building that was in Quabbin. It's down. It's on the way down the street to Seligman on the right. It's this large building. You've walked by it probably 100 times and didn't know it, but I believe it's called King. Who or what is moving, and where are they going? Why? What does it mean to be from a place or from a time? What are the needs of a city? What are the needs of an individual? Can we balance these needs? And if you look at old maps, you can actually figure out exactly where this is. This is a view, again, from the east side. That's now an island. How does climate change amplify these needs? We can gather that the soil was pretty good. I started with ideas of water, a universal human need. Water also symbolizes various things in various cultures. A bridge to the underworld, a dream space, the subconscious, flow and vitality, though here damned and controlled. One of the things that fascinates me about Quabbin is that there are lakes and rivers underwater. And actually, there have been divers who've been down, and you can see where the channels were. There are, as with many human settlements, that's where a lot of the garbage ends up, so you can find out where the riverbanks are underwater. Water appears in various phases and forms, liquid, vapor, clouds, glaciers, ice, each with their own symbolic weight. Water itself has its own story, its own migration through our environment. And this is a shot from a slightly different collection. It's from the Tom Benedek collection. I believe he was at UMass teaching for a while. This is the spillway. I don't know if you know the area. So the dam is off here, and the spillway, the water comes down here. This is just to give you an idea of scale. That's a person. That's another person. This is where the cars go across. Rocks, too, have a story of migration as a result of the last glacial period. They are found scattered throughout New England in the form of erratic boulders, sand, gravel, and endless smaller stones, all creating their own diaspora out of western or eastern Canada and northern New England. Humans collectively form a diaspora from the past, forced into the present, and then on into the foreign future. In a way, the people of these four towns are locked in their place in time and in memory. I have heard many people express the following thought in one form or another. I'm glad my family home is now underwater. It is safe. It can't be a strip mall. It can't be torn down to make condominiums. They may have been forced to move in space, but they are safe in time. And I'm going to play some music for you in a moment. The music you are about to hear is all about place and time. We go into a deep, nostalgic past, perhaps to the farewell ball itself, here inhabited by trees and birds made human in the mind's eye. The film goes black and white. The record skips, itself a displacement of phonograph needle both in space to another groove and time to repeat the immediate past. The graves, some 7,500 or so plots, carefully removed and reinterred in a new cemetery. The fields, now covered in ice, are locked in summer. The birds return, and it is suddenly simultaneously three different seasons at once. Some things about Quabbin will never change. The mountains on the east side are still called mountains. Mount Liz, Mount Pomeroy, Mount L, Mount Zion, etc. I asked a local why they still call these islands Mount. He looked at me like I had asked a dumb question. It speaks to a certain Yankee stubbornness or perhaps optimism. The islands intrude upon the surface of Quabbin and in their nomenclature intrude into the present as a sort of geographic and geologic palimpsest. In a certain way, Atlantis intrudes into the reverie of Part Three. And I should say something about that. Atlantis was a poem that Todd wrote several years ago and sort of formed the seed idea of this. So the music you're going to hear starts out as Part Three, and then about halfway through becomes this older piece, and then eventually becomes Part Three again. So in a similar way, Atlantis intrudes into the reverie of Part Three. Utopic Atlantis has haunted Western culture for millennia. The notion that we were perfect once upon a time, before it all fell apart, before the flood. The speaker looks up through the water at the sun, now turned blue and distant. So I'm going to play some music for you. The footage is just footage of Quabbin on an afternoon a few weeks ago. There's one word that you might not have heard before. It's grebe, G-R-E-B-E. And that's it's a little water bird, which is found around here. The text is pretty dense, but there are subtitles. The music is also quite dense at the beginning, but it mellows here and there. So don't worry if you hate the first 30 seconds. It changes. And this is about 10 minutes. In theory. Let's try again.
Solitary grief.
So that was maybe about a third of the piece. I want to talk about a few other things and then maybe take some questions. What you're looking at right now is what the Hetch Hetchy area used to look like. This is north of the northern part of Yosemite. It was dammed. There's a great book about the San Francisco water whole issue, a fascinating, very different story, capitalism versus water rights. I mean, it's fascinating. The book is called Dam, D-A-M, exclamation point. It's hard to beat that title. But it talks all about Hetch Hetchy. And this is that same area now. The angle's a little bit different, so it's not quite this dramatic, but it is pretty dramatic image. And those who talked about this, the Tuolumne Valley, the native peoples displaced, the poor displaced in order to make water for a city. And those who talk about John Muir in his diaries from the early, 1860, 70, somewhere in there, I can't remember. He talks about the Tuolumne Valley as one of the most beautiful places he's ever been. And when you look into this, if you read, anybody know the book Cadillac Desert, Mark Reisner? Yeah. He talks extensively about water rights in and around Los Angeles, as Los Angeles is being made. And at one point, he's considering damming the Yosemite River and basically turning that whole area into a dam. He talks to a photographer and says, I'm thinking I might send you up there for 6 months just to document it, and then we'll just dam it up. Yeah, thank God they didn't. They're actually talking about undoing this dam, the Hetch Hetchy. It's not as useful as it once was. And they're talking about maybe undoing the dam, which would be wonderful. When I was writing this piece, the Oroville Dam, it's about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, there was the threat of a colossal failure of the Oroville Dam in Northern California, and tens of thousands of people were moved or were threatened with relocation. So this has happened. This is today. This is here. The Colorado River, the creation in the 30s of, I believe it's Lake Mead. I always get Lake Mead and Lake Powell confused, but the Hoover Dam created a huge, huge reservoir for Los Angeles, Las Vegas. The reservoir is now about 40% full. This speaks to where we are in terms of climate and so forth. And the Colorado River rarely makes it out to the Pacific Ocean. Gulf of Mexico. No Pacific.
Really?
It's the Baja. It's right in Baja. Yep. Yep. And if you know anything about the Salton Sea, Salton Sea is another fascinating sort of water situation. It used to be a very, very fashionable place to go, and it's now briny, kind of a mess, but it's great for brine shrimp. So the migrating birds, it's a fascinating place to go for migrating birds, but it's, you would not want to water ski there anymore. Canada, when they created the St. Lawrence, there's a website called sunkenvillages.ca, which has aerial photographs through the water of these towns. In Turkey, about a year and a half ago, the New York Times did a photo essay about a Turkish area that they were threatening with, again, with creating a reservoir there. I don't know if they did or not. I should follow up on that. But that's the, if you're looking, it's Turkey. If you look, New York Times photo essay, Turkey. It's a beautiful photo essay. It's a heartbreaking story. In Spain, under Franco in the 60s, a couple of towns were drowned to make reservoirs again. In Mexico, there is I'm going to look at this one. Nezahualcoyotl Reservoir. Every once in a while, the water level recedes, and there's a 16th century Catholic church that just sort of comes out of the water, and the local fishermen will take you out, and you can go in it. And of course, China, the Three Gorges Dam, 1.2 million people, and countless, I mean, who knows what archaeological things were buried with that. So this is happening, this is today. And all the things we saw on very small scale, right over there, you can almost see it, have been happening since the Roman times with aqueducts. They were working with water 2,000 years ago. So I'm just going to put this up here. If you want to hear more, this recording is available through the Innova label or through the Crossing website or through my own website. And that photo over there is actually similar to the video you saw. I took that with a vintage camera, which did not behave as expected, but actually came up with something far more interesting than I had intended. So that's all I have for remarks, and I'm happy to take questions. Yeah, so the first part is, I pictured the first part as this almost sort of glacier avalanche, this just avalanche, and there's cultural references all over the place, references to early shape note singing. There's actually a big quotation from some shape note singing, some Jeremiah Engels, some Isaac Watts texts that have to do with seeing Canaan across the water with unbeclouded eyes. It's wonderful. References to water in a very spiritual way. The second movement is very placid. It's harmonically calm and very sort of intimate in that way. And that was the movement you heard Todd read. And it's a very almost personal moment. The fourth movement comes back to some of the shape note stuff. These ideas of displacement. When I do with the shape note tune is I actually start, have the choir sing a part, and then they slowly come together, and so they're out of sync with one another, and then gradually come into sync with one another. So it's a real mix of things, and that's one of the things I found very interesting about this whole project, was that it really is this mix of cultures. When we talk about specifically New England, with the influx of the Europeans. And of course, in this area, we have the Native Americans of at least two or three different groups, as well as the Dutch to the south, working their way up the Connecticut River. And when you look at things from colonial Deerfield, you have a mix of English and Dutch pottery, as well as, of course, Native American artifacts. Johnny?
Congratulations on a very interesting piece.
Thank you.
To add to your recent damming works, there's actually one near Hartford a few decades ago. They wrote a book about it called Village of the Damned.
Oh.
I don't think that one went through, but would have bought it, but it's another local case.
Yeah.
I have two questions, very unrelated. The first is, had you already set Atlantis to music before you started working on this piece, or did you do that specifically as part of this piece?
It's a good question. So Atlantis, that section existed as part of a collection called Strange Land. And that was the first piece of his that I found. And I started working on the middle of that first and then slowly worked out. And as Todd finished things, I was able to start working on other things. So it is the oldest music as well. And I never do this, but I actually dreamed part of the music. That never happens to me. And I woke up one morning, and I knew what one of the things was going to be, and I scribbled it out, and that was the beginning.
My second question is, I've also done a project on the Quabbin, a very different kind of piece.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, you've done a lot of historical research. Did you look at any of the other creative pieces that have been done about the Quabbin in preparing to do this one?
I'm aware of a musical, but I was not able to find a copy of that. There are several books been written, and I read what I could get my hands on. There's one novella, which I actually did not end up reading, called E, I believe. Have you read that one?
No, there's a children's book called Someday.
Oh, okay.
And another one called Letting Swift River Go.
Oh, I don't know that one.
And there's a theater company in the area called The Theater Truck.
Mm-hmm.
They did a piece called The Water Project about 18 months ago. If they do it again, they do it at the Swift River Historical Society.
Yep.
It's immersive. I'd highly recommend it.
Oh, I'll keep an eye out for that.
So this is another excellent addition to that group.
And one of the things Todd and I talked very openly about was we wanted to make sure that this was, in a way, historically based and not documentary. And we felt very strongly that if we created a documentary, it would lose the ability to translate to a broader experience. And so we tried very hard to sort of make it honest and truthful without being documentary.
Did you have the idea of something, a piece having to do with the Quabbin before the theme of diaspora came up, or reverse, or did they sort of...
I had a number of pieces that I wanted to write, and this was one of them. And when they came up with diaspora, I proposed a few versions of three or four things, and this was the one that they wanted. But there were no I hadn't written any notes. I just knew that I was very interested in this place, having been there as a student, having walked along the stone walls that sort of just go into the water. There's something very mysterious and poetic about walking down a road and realizing that it keeps going even though you can't keep walking.
Do you know the novel called The Waters of Kronos by Conrad Richter? And I know you're going to say no.
I don't.
It won the National Book Award in 1952 or 53, and it's about a young man or a middle-aged man who goes back to his hometown, and he walks down a hill and he's discovered just that the town has been covered with water, but he is able to walk down through the water and relive some of his early experiences. So
interesting.
I recommend that to you just as something.
Thank you. We had a question here?
Yes, I'm not sure about my back straight. You can perhaps help me. But didn't Sir Malcolm Davies write Farewell to Strongness? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
But his was a protest piece, wasn't it? To try to save it from being damned for a nuclear...
You know, I don't remember.
Yeah,
I'm not very familiar with that piece, to be honest.
Oh,
does anybody here know that Maxwell Davies piece? Do you know it? Well, I'll look it up when I go home. But
because I was thinking, it came to my mind. Mm.
My experience of looking into this was, I expected to be angry. I expected to be outraged, and I found my reaction to be actually much more complex. And my experience of that space has everything to do with, you know, it's a 5-minute drive from my house. I go down there, I'm immersed in this amazing wilderness. And what it provides for migrating birds, for the deer population, for the eagle population. It's been a real boon. And so I have these very conflicting feelings about it. And I think that comes through in the piece. At times it is how could you possibly do that to these people? And then at other times it's, well, how could they possibly have done that to the Nipmuc people? And then I'm thinking from, a hermit thrush. How could they have possibly kicked me off my little perch 5,000 years ago? So, and then of course there's the rocks who are always there, and they're coming and going. The water itself, which has been around forever, and so I didn't settle on angry or elegiac. I think is a good way of thinking about it. So Todd teaches at Phillips Exeter Academy up in New Hampshire. It's a school where I grew up. My dad taught there. And the school, the library at the school, asked me to write a piece on the theme of Shakespeare. And they wanted me to use a local poet, an Exeter poet. So I went to the bookstore and got 7 books, including Rex McGuinn. Did you ever have Rex? So Eric and I are classmates from high school. He happens to be married to an Amherst alum. So I got a bunch of these collections, and Todd's just jumped out. He's a very musical ear, and the cadence of his language and just the musicality of the vowels and how they work through. It's incredibly musical text. And so that immediately jumped out to me. The funny thing is that my wife knew him in Boston when she was studying in Boston when he was directing plays. So it was one of those moments. I was on the couch. I said, "You got to read this guy. He's great." And she flipped over the back and said, "I know this guy." So she's actually known him for far longer than I have. So I wrote a piece called Caliban in Afterlife for soprano, piano, and violin, which is an imagined monologue after Tempest of Caliban looking out as everybody sails away. And it was such a great experience. I knew I wanted to work with Todd again. And so when The Crossing approached me about doing a piece, I said, "I would love to. Can I have Todd work on it with me?" And they said, "Yeah, sure." And so that's how that came about. And I was looking through Todd's first collection, Strangeland, and this Atlantis just jumped out for so many obvious reasons. But also it's... he actually has another poem where he talks about someone being underwater and seeing the washing out on the line, but all underwater. And we thought about including that one too, but this felt like the right one in the right place. In general, what I look for in a poet or a writer is this sense of musicality. There are certain writers that, as a composer, I read their text and I'm already composing. It's I almost have to stop myself because I can't. If I read, I feel like I'm sort of spending that energy and... It's an overwhelming sort of thing. Other writers are very good, but they're not very musical. And when you find that musical writer, I want to work with him again. I've actually got another project set up where he's writing a piece I always forget. It's the myth of the woman who turns into the tree, as opposed to being Daphne, thank you. I always want to say Diana, and it's Daphne, thank you. So he's written a piece, sort of a modern interpretation of Daphne, and I haven't seen it yet. But as soon as I do, I'm going to be probably at the piano for 2 weeks straight. I think we're close on time. If anybody has maybe one more question. Yep, Jen. If you're lucky. And with Donald Nally, I was very lucky. I've worked with him on a few pieces, and he, for whatever reason, he gets me. And, you know, the things that we've talked about are really small things, like that's a little too fast, that's a little too loud. But it can be nerve-wracking, especially if the conductor doesn't really get it, which is no statement, no slur on them. It's just, you know, sometimes, just like there are great writers that I don't feel are musical, there are conductors who have, you know, not gotten my music. And then it's a little more, it becomes a little bit more hands-on, a little more collaborative, like, you know, this is how this goes, and you sing it for them and work through it in a more hands-on way. So I think that's it. Thank you so much for coming and listening.